This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Gongwer News Service editor Zach Gorchow tries to come up with a scenario where Donald Trump wins Michigan in November. But first, Kalamazoo College President Eileen Wilson Oyelaren is retiring. Her last day on the job is June 30th. We sat down last week in her office to discuss her tenure at K College and some of the issues facing higher education. Eileen Wilson Oyelaren, thank you very much for making some time for us.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm pleased to be with you.
I'm going to start with sort of the big picture questions. As you look back on these 11 years at K, what would you rank as the thing you're most proud of?
Well, I think the faculty and staff working together has created a campus that is much more diverse, much more student-focused, and does a better job of preparing our students, I think, for the world they're going to encounter.
And what is the thing that didn't get done these 11 years that you wish you could have checked off before you retired?
Well, we had a strategic plan, and we accomplished all but two of our goals fully. We had hoped to grow to 1,500. We've gotten to be about 1,450, so we're close, but we're not there yet. And because we're a tuition-driven institution, our ability to compensate our faculty and staff is also related significantly to our enrollment. So we didn't make the progress we hoped we would make there. We've made some, but not as much as we would have liked to have done. So I think those two things would be the things that are left undone.
So the goal of increasing enrollment then was tied to being able to pay faculty better. Was that the main purpose then?
No, I think the goal to grow enrollment was really also to create a sense of vibrancy on campus and also to have the right economy of scale for the kinds of majors that we wanted to offer our students. And a byproduct then would be the ability to better compensate faculty and staff.
Is there an upper limit that K College has where if it reaches X number of students, it would fundamentally change the nature of this institution?
That's an interesting question. A lot of liberal arts colleges are growing to about 2,300 comfortably without losing the sense of community on campus. For us, we settled on 1,500 originally because we could do that without new classrooms and without new residence halls. So anything over that would require a significant investment in capital projects. In fact, our science building is almost bursting at the seam now. Because one of the shifts we've seen, K has always been strong in the sciences, but with this national push towards STEM, we're seeing an even greater shift. And so our science building is really popping at the seams.
So it's about trying to grow smartly. Do it the right way so you're not jamming people into classrooms that are too small, et cetera.
Absolutely. And I think for us, it's less the classrooms that are too small, but it's ensuring that we remain a liberal arts college where students are studying all kinds of things. And the conversation that takes place because you're in physics and I'm in art and we suddenly see a connection, or math and music and we see a connection, that's part of the vibrancy, I think, of our community.
But you noted when you announced your retirement that liberal arts colleges seem to be coming under more scrutiny. Do you think that's directly related to cost, the rising cost of college education, more students going into debt, and of course the fact that private schools will have at least a larger sticker price?
Actually, no. I don't think that the assault on the liberal arts is related to cost. I think there are two separate issues. There is an issue of higher education cost, whether you are public or private. So if you're a public institution, the state government has defunded our public institutions of higher education. So they have had to raise their tuitions quite aggressively to meet that hole. Private colleges don't have that support, so their need is to use their tuition to deliver their services. I think that's a separate issue. I think the assault on the liberal arts has come, one, from the economic downturn and the real shift that college is costly, whether it's public or private, and students are carrying more debt, and therefore the need to get a job immediately has kind of shifted the focus of what we see as our mission of educating human beings to preparing people to get a job. And there has been a very narrow construction of the kinds of skills that individuals need to get jobs. So this notion that you won't get a job if you're an English major is absolutely incorrect, but it's out there in the ether right now. We've been very lucky in that our most popular majors really do run across the liberal arts. So we've, you know, business and econ, popular majors, the sciences are popular majors, but so is psychology and English and sociology. So we remain fairly well distributed across, you know, the arts and the sciences.
But I remember speaking to Ray Suarez a couple years ago, right before he came to give the commencement speech here at K College, and he had just done a report for Al Jazeera America, which has since gone under, unfortunately, about student loan debt. And he said that, look, when you go to a place like K College, you're not going to a trade school. And so I wonder there if there's still that balance of you want to be, as he said, I think, a citizen of the world. That's part of what you're going to K for. And at the same time, you do, when you put that much money out, want to be able to have some assurance that you can make a good living at the end of it.
And I think the assurance is absolutely there. I will actually blame you and some of your peers, perhaps, for not fully telling that story. That's one of the reasons, for example, that some of us are doing a lot of talk about STEAM rather than STEM, so that the arts get back in there, because the kind of creativity and innovation that has been so important in the Silicon Valley, it takes that arts perspective as well as the technical perspective, the ability to think critically, to write carefully, to communicate. All of those are seen as central to the economy, but sometimes those stories are not being told.
You mentioned that the student body has become more diverse here at K. How did that happen? Was it outreach? Was it just trying to let people know that you're here, recruiting? What led to it?
Well, I think we were very strategic. The first thing we did is we looked at who was going to be graduating in the next 10 years. We looked at where high school populations were going to be stable or growing, where they were going to be static and declining. Michigan is a state that has had and will continue to have a loss of the number of high school graduates. At least, I think, if my memory serves me well, until 2025, the number of Michigan high school students graduates will continue to decline. And then we decided, where could we go? Where should we be recruiting in light of these demographic shifts? So we changed some of our travel, and we also changed, in some cases, the organizations with which we worked. So in addition to working with high schools, we might be working with community-based groups to begin to tell the Kalamazoo College story. We increased our international recruiting significantly and began to put a lot of focus on that. So there were some very strategic choices that were made.
I have to note, I am, of course, speaking to the first female president of Kalamazoo College, the first African-American president of Kalamazoo College, which leads me to the other question about diversity. Are there opportunities which are opening up for minorities and women in the faculty and the administration in higher education?
I would say absolutely yes. During my time at K, we have enhanced not only the diversity of the student body, but the diversity of the faculty and the staff. I had an opportunity last week to speak with the Michigan ACE Network, which is the network that works with women who are interested in advancing in higher education, and there is a Women of Color Coalition. I would encourage women of all backgrounds to consider higher education as an interesting and very rewarding pathway.
Do you think the opportunities are better there for women than they might be in some other fields if they're thinking about it?
I think they're getting better. I think just like every other field, there was a time when the representation of women was very narrow. I think there is a significant awareness now in the higher ed sector that there's been a strong history of women leaders who've done very well, and I continue to see more women presidents and more women of color presidents.
Kalamazoo College was one of the private schools that agreed to take in students who were part of the Kalamazoo Promise. What has that meant? I know we're still very early in the ball game here in terms of what this might mean down the road, but what do you think it has done for the college so far?
I think it's been really wonderful for individuals in Kalamazoo to have Kalamazoo College as an option. What has been interesting to us is that Kay has continued to recruit a significant number of the students who choose to go to a private institution. And in some ways, that could be counterintuitive because I don't want to go to college in my hometown. And so for us, it's tremendously reaffirming when a student who grew up in Kalamazoo still feels like they want to go to school in Kalamazoo, they want to come to Kalamazoo College, that the college will enhance their development in some way. It, for Kay, is also a significant commitment on behalf of the college because we have to ensure that the students have a full scholarship. And so it has meant a commitment of the college's resources as well. And I'd like to take this opportunity particularly to thank many of the businesses in Kalamazoo who have stepped up to assist us with those scholarships. It's really made a difference for us.
In some way, does that make Kalamazoo College feel a little more like the Kalamazoo part of the title, that it's a little more connected to the town than it was before you had that agreement?
You know, I don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is our students, through our civic engagement program, were so deeply embedded in so many places in the Kalamazoo community that I do think that there was a sense that Kalamazoo College was of the community prior to the promise. I think what it said to people is Kalamazoo College is now giving back in an additional way by making these scholarships available so that students can be at K, you know, working with the promise to make those scholarships available.
How challenging right now are the economics of running a small private school in terms of, as you said, there's no public money coming here. So you're having to do this through tuition. You're having to do fundraising. How much of a squeeze is that?
I think it's a real squeeze. And I think that when the presidents of liberal arts colleges come together, there's a lot of conversation about the business model. We are all, as small liberal arts colleges, being called to look at what is the core of what we do, teaching and learning, and what in some ways might be considered auxiliary, and what might that mean in the future. There, I would predict that in the future, there are going to be lots of conversations about what can be shared.
And at the schools, it maybe could be some sort of partnership.
Right, and schools trying to create partnerships as they respond to it. I talked about the decline of the Michigan high school graduation rate and also the shifting demographics in terms of racial and ethnic backgrounds. We're also at a time when we're seeing greater income inequality. And so many of the students who are graduating from high school and who are college capable and college ready are coming from families who don't have the financial capacity for a public or a private institution. So that's also pressing on the model because we want to be able to support those students. And that's one of the reasons that the generosity of our donors has meant so very much to us. We were able to raise over $19 million in scholarships as part of our campaign. And that is going to enable us to continue to provide opportunities. So it's a careful balance between those who pay it back to the college, having been there, and the tuition, and how we really think about everything we do. And it's going to be challenging for all of our institutions.
Beyond fundraising, as you step away from higher education, what would you say are the biggest challenges that will be awaiting your successor, as well as other people who are leading institutions, whether they be a state university or a private college like Kay?
I think that young people, gratefully, are becoming much more concerned about the larger issues in the world, whether they're issues of income inequality or police brutality or racism or domestic violence, sexual violence, and that activism is coming on our campuses. And it's coming on our campuses at a time when the young people who are coming to our campuses have had very few models of civil discourse. And that's going to be a challenge for all of our campuses. You know, you and I can decide what we want to listen to, and we can listen to those stations and really not be called to intellectually engage with a different point of view. So that is our mission as educational institutions, to have people engage with the hard issues of their time, but in a real intellectual, critical way. And we will have to get our students, help them develop that capacity at the same time they're trying to change the world. And it's going to be messy. Exciting, but messy.
Eileen Wilson Oyelaren, thank you very much for your time, and enjoy your retirement.
Thank you so very much.
I spoke with Kalamazoo College President Eileen Wilson Oyelaren last week in her office. She is leaving that office soon. Wilson Oyelaren is retiring after 11 years as K College's president. Her last day is June 30th. Jorge Gonzalez will take over as the new president of Kalamazoo College. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. When we last spoke with Gongwer News Service editor Zach Gorchow in May, we discussed how Donald Trump's campaign for president could affect Republicans down the ballot in Michigan, in particular one Kalamazoo area state house race. But we ended that conversation with the caveat that Trump might do better than expected, especially in certain areas of the state. Zach Gorchow has written another blog post for Gongwer about Donald Trump, this time trying to come up with a scenario where the likely Republican nominee takes Michigan's 16 electoral votes in November. Zach Gorchow, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
So I want to begin by telling our audience that we are speaking Friday afternoon by the time people hear this. It is possible that Donald Trump will have made news in other ways that might have people rethinking what he might be able to do in November. And I want to note, Zach, that in your piece, you say you are skeptical, very skeptical, about whether or not Donald Trump could actually win Michigan. But give us some factors that might lead to a surprise in the fall.
Well, if you're trying to game out how Trump could get the votes to win Michigan, it's a big, big hill to climb. But I sort of came up with four things that could at least get him within striking distance if they were to happen. Not saying they're necessarily all going to happen, just this is one way that I would say it could happen if it was going to happen. So one would be lower turnout in Detroit, largely because of population loss, but maybe also a little bit because you don't have the first major party African-American nominee for president. I went back and looked, and John Kerry pulled, I believe, 305,000 votes out of Detroit in 2004. I don't think anyone would say John Kerry was a particularly strong candidate. He wasn't terrible, but it's not like he was generating a lot of excitement. Well, in 2012, President Obama running for re-election got 281,000 votes and change out of the city of Detroit. That's a population loss factor there. And certainly some of those votes may have shown up in other communities. But nonetheless, that was a substantial decline in the vote out of Detroit, and the population there has only continued to decrease since then. So, you know, is it possible, you know, Trump would need a substantial diminishment there in the vote out of Detroit to cut into this gap he has to overcome? There's also been discussion that he could generate a greater turnout among non-traditional white voters, people who aren't regular voters, but, you know, feel sufficiently motivated by his messages to come out and vote. I think there's some pretty conflicting data on whether that's true, especially if you look at national polling right now. That may just be more of a hope than reality among Trump supporters. But at least that's one of the items in play. Macomb County, would have to figure big into any Trump strategy. You've heard some anecdotal reports, people saying that they're finding candidates who are out there campaigning, saying they're finding a lot of support for Trump in parts of the county. It's a county that has always appreciated and likes big, brash candidates. You go over there, you'll be amazed. You know, you don't have yard signs over there. You've got, like, billboards in people's yards. I mean, it's a totally different deal. Just people will put up, you know, these huge signs. People like politicians who throw punches. You know, Trump's working class message has a potential to play well there. Message against offshoring and outsourcing. You know, it's a county that is, while it's getting more diverse, is still largely white and has a history of favoring candidates who play racial politics. So, which I think most people would say Donald Trump has been doing. So, you know, Macomb County there, you know, it typically is a close at the presidential level. You know, George W. Bush did win it in 2004, but by a small margin. Donald Trump would need to win Macomb County by a large margin, like 10 to 15 percentage points. And then there's the possibility for disaffected Bernie Sanders supporters. And these would need to be people who usually would vote for the Democratic candidate. So people who voted for Barack Obama and John Kerry and so forth, who support Bernie Sanders this time, who decide they just can't vote for Hillary Clinton. These can't be new voters or non-traditional voters, because if they just stay home, well, it doesn't really make a difference to Donald Trump. These would have to be people who have traditionally come out and vote for the Democratic presidential candidate and decide, no, I'm either not going to vote or I'm going to vote for the Green Party candidate. If you were to put enough of those things together with enough votes adding up, you could see it becoming a state that's legitimately in play. I don't see it happening, but I thought it was important to at least try to figure out what kind of factors would need to happen to give Donald Trump a chance.
And if we look at those factors that you've mentioned, lower voter turnout in Detroit and Wayne County, Trump doing extremely well in Macomb County, more white voters turning out in certain parts of the state, and maybe some Bernie Sanders voters who normally would vote for the Democratic candidate, perhaps voting for the Green Party candidate or even staying home. Out of those, which would you say is the most likely to happen?
Well, I think the lower turnout in Detroit is pretty well a certainty just by the numbers. I mean, the population there has shrunk. You know, it's hard to imagine that Hillary Clinton can match the excitement level in Detroit because she's not Barack Obama. She's not the first major party African-American candidate for president. Detroit is a overwhelmingly majority African-American city. So I think when you add those things up, I would assume the vote for Hillary Clinton out of Detroit will be less than the 281,000 votes Barack Obama received in 2012. By how much, you know, I can't say for sure, but I think that is pretty likely. The other factors, I think, are pretty speculative.
So out of those, they're maybe not as likely to happen. And are you saying in your blog that you think that Trump needs this entire combination? He needs all of these things to happen if, in fact, he's going to make a serious run at winning Michigan?
I mean, these are the things that I could come up with. And there are other factors. I mean, hey, if Hillary Clinton gets indicted or something, you know, or if she just, you know, some sort of disaster befalls her. I mean, although, you know, there's another factor that could come into play. But at least, you know, this was sort of a brainstorm on my part. And brainstorming them, you know, what I came up with trying to look at the numbers, I think he would need all four of these. I mean, I took as a baseline the best a Republican presidential candidate has done in the streak of Democrats winning the presidential race in Michigan the last six elections, which was 2004, George W. Bush. Lost by about 160,000 some votes, 3% and change. That's the best a Republican has done since 1988 here. And so I sort of said, well, if you're trying to erase 160,000 vote margin, how would you do it? And these were the four things I could come up with and at least draw a semi-plausible to plausible argument for them happening to add up to that 160,000 votes and change.
Donald Trump's political strategist in Michigan, Scott Hagerstrom, made some news this week by saying that Michigan is winnable for the Trump campaign. Both the Detroit papers picked that up and put it at least prominently on their websites. I guess I'm just kind of wondering, and now we're going to give it some more attention here, should we really be surprised that someone who is working for Donald Trump in Michigan is trying to make the case that this is a state they can win? He really can't get up in front of people and say, we're just here playing out the string and we're going to take donations, that's just going to vanish into thin air.
Yeah, no, this would definitely fall under the, you know, the sun rose in the morning and it set at night. I mean, you know, if you are the paid manager of a campaign for anything and you say anything other than that your candidate has a chance to win, you're not really doing a very good job. You know, you're always going to, you know, put things in the best possible light. So, you know, of course, Scott Hagerstrom, you know, is going to say and should say that his candidate has a chance to win Michigan. You need to keep, you know, your voters motivated. I mean, think back to what the disaster that occurred in 2008 when, for reasons I still don't fully understand, the McCain campaign put out the word that it was pulling up stakes in Michigan. I mean, the bottom fell out for the Republicans here as a result. I mean, there's just a huge morale crusher for Republican voters then. You've got to at least keep up appearances as much as you can.
So as I said, the last time we talked to you, it was about what Donald Trump's campaign for president could mean down the ballot. Let's look at that maybe going the other way for a moment here. There's a lot of key Republicans, Congressman Fred Upton from this part of the state, Justin Amash from Grand Rapids, among them, saying that they're not going to endorse Trump. Those are a couple of two very different Republicans. And if there are, you know, Republican office holders and people who are prominent in the party who are staying on the sidelines, does it make it even less likely that that combination of events that Donald Trump needs to be competitive, much less win Michigan, is just less likely to happen?
You know, there's not a lot of certainties in politics because there's always exceptions to rules and so forth. But I do feel pretty strongly that divided political parties lose, that you need to be unified. And right now there's a lot of division. And in both parties, I mean, you know, the Bernie Sanders people clearly are struggling with the idea of rallying behind Hillary Clinton, but at least among the elected, you know, Democratic establishment, you are seeing the Democratic establishment clearly fall in line with Hillary Clinton. The Republican establishment, there is just an extraordinary amount of angst and hand-wringing and upset and unwillingness to coalesce behind Donald Trump. You know, you saw it from Fred Upton. You're seeing it from members of Congress. You're seeing
Governor Snyder.
Yeah. I mean, you're just, it is pretty extraordinary to have a situation now where you have the presumptive nominee of the party and people just not will saying that, you know, they just can't get behind him because of the things he's saying and doing. If that doesn't change, it's going to be really ugly. Typically, you want your candidate to win about 90% of their party's vote. And that's what we've seen, that President Obama, George W. Bush, Mitt Romney, et cetera, et cetera. They'll typically win about 90 to 95% of their party's vote. When you start to fall below 90, you know, 85 doesn't sound bad, but that's a lot of lost votes. Those are votes that you were assured of getting. And suddenly they're gone, and you know they bled out your back pocket. Even if Trump gets 80-85%, that's going to take a big toll. Presuming Hillary Clinton gets 90-95%, you know, as long, you know, if she's down there too, well, you know, maybe it's a little bit of a wash. But Trump seems to have a lot more problems right now in terms of coalescing the establishment of the party behind him.
Zach Gorchow, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Zach Gorchow is the editor of the Gongwer News Service. A link to his blog post called Trying to Game Out How Trump Could Win Michigan can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.